ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
You're such faithful devotees. I was talking to a couple devotees in the parking lot who are one of them here for the first time, and one of the devotees' names is Shruti, and I was telling her about how our process for advancing spiritually is simple because it's something we're equipped for, everyone's equipped for. We have two ears, and actually they're designed quite nicely. They come free of charge along with the human body. They're perfectly designed to catch vibrations in the atmosphere. And think about that, how they're channeled and they go inside. And where do they go? That's a big question. Where do those sound vibrations end up? In the heart. Yeah, they end up in the heart, and having a change of heart depends on what kind of vibration we hear. So, Shruti, when we hear transcendental sound vibration, when we hear vibration that comes from the spiritual world, we can actually connect with the spiritual world. This is yoga. So hearing is the primary process of yoga, to be connected with the spiritual world. I was giving Shruti the example about the salmon who live in the forest in Mir Woods. As one day I took some devotees from Hungary to Mir Woods to show them around. They wanted to see a little bit of what California is like. Such a diverse environment here. You can go to the ocean, you can go to the mountains, you can go to the forest, and there's still a little forest left. Fortunately, it wasn't all cut down. There's a tiny little piece of forest called Mir Woods that was spared because of the heroics of one political personality who was able to, or a person who owned it, who was able to turn it into a national park. Actually, it's even more than a national park. It's something that's owned particularly by the government and is supposedly eternally protected. But in that forest, there's a little stream, and in the stream, there are fish. There's life going on everywhere in this universe. And some of those fish are very important to the environment. They're called the Kehoe salmon. And those salmon are remarkable. If you follow their life, and some people do, this is what the life of biologists are. They pick out one living entity and they just watch what he or she does for a lifetime. And then they come up with the amazing feats of material nature. Salmon in that river are born, and then after about a year, their body starts to change a little bit. And then they swim downstream and they go to the ocean. And in the ocean, they swim around for a couple of years, and they can go thousands of miles. And then they come back to the original stream that they emerged from, and they swim upstream. And they go back to the original pond that they were conceived in and born in. And there they mate, and they produce offspring, and then they die. And as best as scientists can tell from doing all kinds of weird experiments, the salmon finds its way back to its original home by smell. And as we found that information out, actually it happened one day, as I said, when I was with these devotees from Hungary, we happened to meet a ranger that was in the stream with gator boots on and a long pair of tongs and a big barrel, and he was pulling little pieces of trash out of the water, which he called micro trash, and he said it disturbs this fish's sense of direction because it interferes with their smell. And then he told us the story of the salmon. And as we walked away, I was thinking, it just came into my mind about how the process of spiritual life, as directed by the Srimad Bhagavatam, is predominantly by hearing. And that just as the salmon have this very strong sense of direction because of their smell. So similarly, as human beings, our souls have this sense of direction. We gain a sense of direction by our sense of hearing. It's kind of remarkable that therefore the process we engage in is begins with shruti, begins with hearing. And when we hear from the right source, when we can divine what is the right source, when I say divine, there's a process for finding water that some people are really expert at, water divining. They take these rods, and generally there's, sometimes people think this is mythology, but actually I was talking to some devotees that live in Costa Rica, and they say that there are natives who live there who are so expert that they defy modern science, who thinks this is all mythology about finding water. And they're so in tune with the environment, and there's a way that they walk around on the land and they can find where you drill the well. And they can feel the vibration of water, they can see it in the environment, and they actually find it. And someone may say, well, that's mythology, but actually it works. And we have to divine, we have that capability within us to divine the source of sound that will connect us to the spiritual world. We can use our intellect. It's God-given. In the human form of life, we have a God-given intellect through which we can divine where that source of sound is that will actually help take us back home. And when we find that out, and we can control our senses, regulate our senses to continuously hear that sound, then the Bhagavatam says, Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. When you hear from the Bhagavat, then inauspiciousness begins to dissipate in your life, just like that. It's a kind of medicine. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, speaking in the voice of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Enechiya Shodi Maya Nashi Bharo Lagi, that it's like medicine. The sound itself is like a medicine that enters within the ears, within the heart, and as if in a systemic way goes throughout one's life. It pervades one's consciousness. And then by that, one knows where to step, how to move in life. One gains spiritual intelligence, spiritual intuition. And the obstacles that face one in one's progress in spiritual life begin to dissipate naturally, because there's reciprocation in the universe, which is the most exciting aspect of our philosophy of Krishna consciousness. When we talk about perfection in life, there are many schools of thought who propose that the ultimate goal is nirvana, which means simply that we stop the course of material life altogether. But then where do you go? What's left? What's the life part? What's the movement that we're all seeking for? It can't just be suspended forever or extinguished altogether. The very concept of that is a little bit daunting. But there's a way in which, through the philosophy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, one not only removes obstacles from one's life, but then begins to gain a sense of one's real identity. And that identity is in relationship with the Supreme Consciousness. And there's reciprocation. This is the point. There's reciprocation. So the Bhagavatam also says that Shrinvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hridyam Taksto Hibhadrani Vidunoti Suhritsatam. There's a Suhrit. There's actually a loving, supreme person who lives in our heart. That's the great revelation of those on the path of bhakti yoga. And he assists us as we sincerely try to apply the process. And what is the application? Again, simply putting oneself in front of spiritual sound vibration, taking the medicine repeatedly. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, hearing from the Bhagavad Gita, which is reveals the mind of God, and who wouldn't want to know about that? And also the Srimad Bhagavatam, which reveals the heart of God. And through these sound vibrations, which are recorded for posterity, we can actually come in contact with the mind and heart of the Supreme and feel the reciprocation of the Supreme. Just by hearing the Bhagavat, which is a divine vibration, the Srimad Bhagavatam says that the Lord becomes inclined to live within the heart of the devotee. Not just inclined, but he becomes captured because the vibration is so powerful. It has to be in order to attract the Supreme. It has to be really the most powerful force in the universe, if it's even more powerful than God, to attract his attention or to capture him. And this is the philosophy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that the internal energy of the Lord, which comes through the Srimad Bhagavatam, is even more powerful than Krishna himself because it attracts him. It is the internal energy that is interesting to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we have access to that. And one of the most amazing points of our philosophy, those who are followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is that in the age of Kali, people practically have no qualification whatsoever for such detailed understanding of spiritual life. Nonetheless, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is distributing the highest concepts of spiritual life to the masses, and he gives a process that's encapsulated in a system that's seemingly so easy, and actually it is, but that helps one enter deeply within the philosophy for oneself. The chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, which is 16 words, 32 syllables. I was thinking about it this morning when I was chanting. Two syllables at a time. It's just one, two, one, two, one, two, one, two. It's very simple. You can keep going if you take shelter of these two syllables. There's Hare, Hare. Hare. Then there's Krishna. And Rama. Two syllables each, right? Nice and even. And within that mantra is the entire spiritual world and access to all spiritual knowledge. I noticed that the devotees set up a table over here with a set of Sri Chaitanya Charitamritas. I just want to appreciate the fact that it's there first. I was thinking today, earlier this morning, about how important books are in human society. Sometimes people say, why don't you just give me the e-copy, which is also nice. But there's something that I find from many, many people, and I hear from them, that they appreciate the aesthetic value of a physical book. And since I recently wrote a book and had it published, I'm also seeing that it's not only a physical object, but it also has something within it. I mean, hopefully the book I wrote has something. I'm talking about books in general. I don't know if it has anything in it that's of particular use, but in general, books have this dual nature. First of all, there's an aesthetic quality. You can hold them. You can put them in, so they take up space somewhere. For people who like books, they take up a lot of space. They could take up your whole house, actually. I know Pradyumna, who was Prabhupada's Sanskrit editor, devotees have told me, I haven't been into his house, but they said, you can't even get in because there's books everywhere. But recently when we were in Jagannath Puri, we went over to Madhavananda and Krishna Kun's house. And every room, I mean, they have a small sleeping area, like a little cot in the corner, but the rest of the house is taken up with these beautiful armoires filled with treasures of books. They're very well preserved. Each one has a glass, a covering, and a lock on it, so the books are preserved and so forth. And we heard also recently that Jiva Goswami was admired for his library amongst all the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. He collected a library that was something that people sought after. His books were pretty rare. And so the book has a particular prominence in human society. and has for years, even before people could produce books the way they are produced now in mass quantity, people always tried to write things down. They wrote on shells. They wrote on pieces of bark. I mean, even up to fairly recently, the Goswami literatures and everything were written on tree bark by hand. On what? Stones, yeah, written on stones. And because human beings have this chit-shakti. Chit-shakti means they want knowledge. They desire knowledge. And you'll notice they're curious. And if they're given the right kind of knowledge, if they're put in front of the right kind of knowledge, it actually transforms them. Krishna says so in the Bhagavad Gita, that there's an effect from transcendental knowledge that is experienced in due course of time, that actually one experiences one's sublime nature. So the aesthetic of the book, and there's some pride in owning books. Sometimes people own books. My parents collected books. There were all kinds of art books. When I helped to close down my family home, because most of my parents passed away one year after the other, my siblings and I came there, and it took us a long time to pack up all the books. There were art books. There were books about music. And I dare say they didn't read them all. I mean, nobody sits there and goes through every single one of them, especially those art books and things like that. But there was a feeling that they got from those books. So someone was telling me recently about the science of Vastu and how every object in this world has its own influence on our lives. And the kinds of things we keep around us influence us. People who live in clutter tend to be in anxiety a lot because there's so much influence from the chaos of things around them. And when one keeps transcendental literature, there's an influence. And when one takes transcendental literature into one's home. So I was thinking also, and I've been talking about the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is this set of books over here recently, and that it's not widely known in the world. It's not like you walk into a bookstore and you'll see it as a bestseller. There's a lot of books. I check them out when I go to bookstores anywhere. I was recently in Frankfurt stopping over, and I went into the bookstore and looked around and see what's selling. What are people reading? Hey, people are definitely interested in philosophy. There are different books about how to get things done, how to make your life more, how to simplify your life, be more sublime, be more aware of things. And people are after that kind of thing. But I didn't find the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. And nor is it even in the amongst our whole ISKCON society, it's not widely distributed. And I was thinking how there's a huge opportunity there because Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur sought after this book as the primary text from which he would expand the Krishna consciousness movement. That was the basic text that inspired him to organize a worldwide movement, to envision a worldwide movement, and instill the ideas of that worldwide movement into his disciple and son, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who said that the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita was his life and soul, and that if all other books in the world somehow or other, probably because of global warming, slipped into the ocean and were lost, but the Chaitanya Charitamrita was left behind, there would be no loss. Because everything's in there. The Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the important Puranas, Puranic quotes are all in there, strung in a garland, perfectly formed, so that one can understand the pinnacle of spiritual, the goal, the highest goal of spiritual life. And in the life of our founder Acharya, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the Chaitanya Charitamrita has a prominent role also. He brought it with him on the Jaladuta. And although he suffered on that trip two heart attacks, and you can just imagine the spiritual anxiety he was in going to a new place, leaving behind all semblance of comfort. And he said his only solace was the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. He read it constantly as he went across the ocean. If something gives solace to the great souls, one might want to look into it. What's in that? That it's giving solace to those who are above the three modes of material nature. And then when he came to America, he hit the ground running. so to speak. He was on a marathon. As soon as he landed, he knew he didn't have any time to waste. You see, on the cover of this book I just published, there's a picture of Prabhupada holding a Srimad Bhagavatam. It's kind of a spiritual Mona Lisa. You know, the Mona Lisa is something, anybody ever seen it? Ever gone there to see it? Yeah? My parents took me there when I was a kid. Everyone just stand there and look at it, and you just marvel at the expression. That's part of the thing. It's like, is she smiling? Is she pensive? What is she thinking? And so forth. Well, there's a spiritual Mona Lisa, and it's on the cover of this book called Our Family Business. And it's Prabhupada when he landed in America. He's just on the shore of America, and he's in Butler, Pennsylvania, which is just a brief stopover point before he goes who knows where. He didn't even know where he was going from there, for sure, except he knew that he was going to fulfill the order of a spiritual master. And what step he would take would be guided by Krishna and the Bhagavatam, which he said when he was on the Jalatutin. And in this picture, he's holding a copy of the Bhagavatam that he had published in India. And he's looking off a little bit into the distance. And the expression on his face, I call a spiritual Mona Lisa. You try to think, what is he thinking? What is he contemplating while holding that Bhagavatam and seeing into the future how the Krishna consciousness movement would be spread all over the world? So as he brought out the Bhagavatam and that other books, and of course it's a painstaking process, and methodically he wrote and published. And in 1975, he came out with the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. That is, he had translated and given commentary to it, but it's difficult to publish books, very difficult. But I told the story on Saturday, and I won't repeat it now, but there's a way in which there's a famous incident that took place where he called all the leaders of the Krishna conscious movement from all over the world to come to Los Angeles so that he could make a statement. And he made that statement not only in the temple room but also on Venice Beach when he asked the producers to publish the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. Oh, there's a picture of the book. That's the picture of Prabhupada that I'm talking about. Can you see his expression? I mean, it's enchanting, isn't it? He induced a marathon, which was practically an impossible task, to produce the entire, to publish, to the pre-press, the editing, the production, the printing, distribution of the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita within 2 months. 2 months. 15 books. Which is really impossible to do. But practically all of ISKCON became focused on this marathon in Los Angeles, and the devotees worked literally 24 hours a day around the clock to do the paintings, to do the work on the book, to have them published. Halfway through, some of the books were ready and were shipped to Los Angeles, unbeknownst to the devotees there, and the publishers there in Los Angeles arranged to put them on the altar before Mangalartik. So when the doors opened, the fruit of the work, at least half of it, was visibly present on the altar with Sri Sri Rukmini Dwarkadish. And one of those BBT workers told me that practically all the devotees were crying when the doors opened and they saw. Because when you put your heart into some yajna, when you really work hard for Krishna, and then you see the magnificent result that comes for the pleasure of Krishna, there's a way that you feel exalted and you feel the reciprocation. It's something very wonderful. So that happened, and then the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita came out to the world, and Prabhupada, of course, asked his devotees to distribute it. Why else would you take the trouble to put it into a book if you didn't want it distributed? So this spells a great opportunity, and I would say it's one of the great frontiers of book distribution. And that is the distribution of the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, because practically it's untouched. Not that many copies have been distributed, the full sets, around the world. And it's an intriguing challenge, because this is the most esoteric of all the Gaudiya Vaishnava literatures. And the whole philosophy of Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita shows the actual activities of the spiritual world and the exchanges of love between Krishna and his devotees. Is the world ready for it? I don't know. Probably not quite yet. At least not in America, it seems. But they will be. And they, by contact with these transcendental literatures, get great benefit. The whole world does. The vastu, just the vastu, coming, the emanation, the spiritual power of these books entering into people's lives, when these objects show up in libraries and in people's homes and all kinds of institutions around the world, they have a powerful spiritual effect. How else will we affect change? It doesn't happen from a political level. You can see that people all over the world, like in the system of democracy, they're not qualified to vote for anybody because they don't know anything. They don't know anything. And they're unqualified to decide who should lead them and so forth. That comes out for me very clearly during these election cycles. The people are clueless, and they've been left to languish in ignorance. And so it is the mission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness to widely distribute transcendental knowledge. So this is the highest spiritual literature on the planet. It is already published. It's already put into little capsules, into containers that can float all over the world and actually have an impact. We call the nuclear option. People are threatening all over the world, you know, we have a bomb now. We have a real bomb. We have the smartest bomb there is in the world, and we have to distribute it. We have to make it available to people. This is our mission. And in the process of trying to explain what this book is, one becomes actually edified, and one becomes educated oneself. You have to rise to a higher level to actually appreciate what is this literature. I mean, come on. It was appreciated by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. What to speak of Vishwanath Chakravarti. All the great acharyas said, this is the book. But who wouldn't want to have that close to them? And who wouldn't want to try to induce other people to take it? Even if they don't know what it is, it's like the biggest spiritual joke in the world to take it in and drop this bomb in people's house. They're sitting there watching TV, and the next thing you know, the highest spiritual literature in the universe appears in their house. Now what's going to happen? Let's see them fight it out with that in their house. What will be the impact of that? So that's why we're putting them out, because we know that this is actually the heart of the Krishna consciousness movement. These books are what actually make this an institution. An institution is the means through which culture is spread across time and geography. How does one spread the Krishna conscious ideology and the culture across time and geography? Through literature. Through literature. Our institutions, the buildings we're making, I mean, people are putting a lot of money into building all these big temples. My proposal is cut the budget in half and give us the rest for distributing Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. I'm just saying. give us $15 million a year, and we'll do some damage in the world by dropping these bombs. Why not? Or keep building the buildings at the same rate and still give us $15 or $30 million a year, and we'll do the work. Krishna, please. So having said that, I want to say a few words about something that happened yesterday during the class, and that is Dainidhi Prabhu called in, and he asked a question that made me think overnight. It was a very simple question, but it's something that I was I think is very essential in a practical way to our spiritual life, and that is, he asked, what does it mean to do your best? It's something that we might want to know in any aspect of our life, but since we're in a spiritual context here, I want to talk about it a little bit from the point of view of how to do one's best in spiritual life. So, first of all, we have to have a little bit of a context about what is the best thing in life. Or even more properly, we might want to know what is a thing in general. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in 2:16, Nasato vidite bhavo na bhavo vidite sita ubaryorapi dushtuntas twanios tatvadarshi bihi. Interestingly, Krishna is referring to the great sages, the darshi bhis, those who have seen the truth. Of course, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but then he refers to other authorities as well in the Bhagavad Gita. And there he says that there are two categories of things in this world. Some of them are real, he said, and some of them are not so real. And this is a starting point for the Bhagavad Gita. You have to figure out what's real and what's not real, because we live in a bi-dimensional universe. And the energy that is temporary is considered to be not real. It's not false, but it's temporary, and it's constantly changing. The energy that makes up our body, that makes up the physical, gross, and subtle body, is mutable. It's constantly changing. And it's not dependable. It's unstable. It's an unstable environment. So sages have looked at both the energies very carefully, studied them through shastra, studying them through meditation, and have concluded, and this is very important, that one is real and the other one isn't. So one very essential point that Prabhupada brings out in his teaching is that anything that's done artificially, it doesn't bring you the result that you're searching for. How's that? Nirkula, did you have a point? I saw you went to put on the microphone. Oh, okay. Could everyone please move up by 7 by 7.2 inches? And if anybody knows how to convert that into meters, centimeters, let me know. Because maybe some of you are on the metric system. And if there's any gaps, fill in the gaps. I hate gaps. 18 centimeters, please move up. For those of you oriented towards the metric system. What is it? Oh. Okay. Well, that feels better right there, because we're all closer. So this is a nice meditation for starting the conversation about how to do one's best. And that is, Krishna says in 2:16, those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the external, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. Okay, just so I don't get monotonous, I'm going to take a few reflections just to start off. Basically, we'll talk about this as a foundational aspect for moving into the conversation of how to do one's best. Some reflections so far. Yes, Prashant. How's the temperature in here? It's a little warm, no air. Can we remedy that? Air is good. Good for the brain. Okay.
Hare Krishna, Babaji. First of all, thank you for that Biology 101 primer. I didn't know that salmon can find their way back home by the sense of smell.
Yeah.
But I think what is important to me was what followed after that, how you kind of mentioned that the human being have a sense of direction through hearing. And this is what will lead them back to the Godhead.
That's good. That helps the conversation. Because I'm going to introduce four elements that are important in doing one's best. And one of them is something that Prashant just brought up, and that is that one must have a goal. Because doing one's best requires a little activity, doesn't it? As Prabhupada used to say, Krishna instructed Arjuna at Kurukshetra, and he didn't tell him that, all right, now you sit down on the chariot and smoke ganja, and I'll do the fighting. He said, you fight. You do your best to fight, but you be an instrument in the fight. And Prabhupada explains this analogy of an instrument, just like if a person is confronted with a dangerous snake who's on the attack, and he has to kill the snake, he may take a big stick and hit the snake. And the stick or the man is responsible for killing the snake. The man, not the stick. If you take it to a court of law and say, no, it was... it's the stick, it's not me. The stick killed him. They won't buy it. There's no legal theory that will support that. So, well, of course, you know, if you're pushed into somebody and involuntarily, and the videotape shows that somebody pushed you and you bumped into somebody and they fell off a cliff or something like that, you're not going to be held responsible because the intentionality is important. But in this analogy, Prabhupada says that we have to become the stick in the hands of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that is, Krishna throughout the Bhagavad Gita says, work, you have to do your work, but don't be the doer. How do you do that? Be an instrument. Be an instrument in the hands of Krishna. Now, having a goal means that you have to work for something. But how do you work for it? You do it in yoga. There's the yoga of action that Krishna describes in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He says there's a cycle of action in this world, a wave in which one works so that one's work is actually sacrifice. And one does it out of gratitude. One realizes there's a reciprocation in the universe. I'm being provided with so many facilities. And therefore, out of a feeling of gratitude, I'm giving something back. And this is called there's this cycle of sacrifice out of gratitude. One gives back, and one's working for a higher cause. And then in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called Action in Krishna Consciousness, it's a kind of renunciation to work and do one's duty. Do what you have to do, but then dedicate all of the results, just like an instrument would do, to one's benefactor, the one who's providing one with all the facility for doing the work in the first place, and not claiming proprietorship over it. In this way, Krishna says, Brahmanyadaya karmani sangam tyakva karotiya lipyatena sapapena padma patram ivambasa. You won't become affected by the sinful nature of the world, which means you don't become implicated when you work like that. And he gives the comparison of a lotus flower that's in the water, but it's not touched by water. So doing one's best means that, first of all, you have to be doing something. But how are you doing it? You need to have a goal. You need to work in the right kind of consciousness. And having a cherished goal and keeping it in front of you is very helpful to doing your best, because you have a marker to see how far along you're going. As you're making your daily endeavors, you have to know, what am I trying to hit? What kind of goal am I trying to hit? So it helps to actually define what your goal is. In fact, it's very energizing. If you take a little time to define what your vision and goal is, one devotee recently sent me his life's vision statement that spanned over about 20 years. He's a young devotee. And I thought, and it took him a while to write it down. He was contemplating, he was given some advice, write what your vision in life is. What are you trying to accomplish as a devotee of Krishna? And he wrote it all down. And just by reading it, I felt inspired, and then he really felt inspired because he had something that he could look at and say, this is what I'm going for. This is what I'm going for. And if you have a marker, who? No, it was, I don't know if I should say his name or not, but it wasn't him. Although that would seem characteristic of his kind of thing. Okay, so one aspect is to have a cherished goal and keep it in front of you. Because when you're doing, you have to know where you're going. Otherwise, you just do and you don't know if you've done the right thing or not. You have to know if you're heading towards your goal. So keeping that in mind and defining your goal in life as clearly as possible as you go along is very helpful to doing your best in life. You can't just wait around for something good to happen to you also. So you have to be a little active in trying to reach your goal. So another aspect of doing your best, interestingly, is to not overdue. And in the Nectar of Instruction, we're given this prohibition. In other words, Rupa Goswami, as I mentioned last week, has given 6 items that help one advance and 6 items that hold one back from advancing. And one of the items that holds one back from advancing in devotional service is over-endeavor, doing more than you're qualified to do at the present moment. Of course, as we've talked about previously, and you do a little research into this idea of overdoing things, you also don't want to underdo it also. Because that's also possible. Say, okay, I'll never be qualified, I can't move forward. So don't overdo means don't overstep what you can actually do naturally and not artificially. If you artificially try to do more than you're capable of doing right now, it won't help you. And I quoted maybe yesterday, Sway Sway Adhikariya Nishta Saguna Parikirtata. That Krishna says in the Bhagavatam that everyone has some qualification according to their previous association and activities. We come into the world with a kind of a capacity. And if you act according to that capacity, and it's no harm, doesn't matter how high you fly, because the sky's unlimited and birds fly according to their capacity. You fly according to your capacity. It's a good quality, Krishna says. Act according to what you can do right now. And knowing what that is, by getting good association and good advice, so that you're properly situated, is very helpful to know what your capacity is, so you can act accordingly. Very helpful. Now, in considering doing your best, you can also consider this, that along with creation, there's fault. We're in a created world. We're in a created body. And the creation means that it's not going to be perfect. Only things that are not created are perfect. And that's why I quoted the verse in the beginning, nasato vidite bhavo, na bhavo vidite sat. It's already established. Some things are perfect, and they're not created. Those things that are created, that come into this world, are imperfect evidence. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that 1848. Sahajam karma kunteya sadosham apinatya jet sarvaramba hidoshina duminagnir ivavrataha. Every endeavor is covered by some fault, just as fire is covered by smoke. Therefore, one should not give up the work born of his nature, O son of Kunti, even if such work is full of fault. So, in this bi-dimensional universe, we have the level of work we're doing in relationship to the material body that we have to maintain the status quo. And in relationship to that, Prabhupada says, detachment and devotion while working, not renunciation of the activity, will cancel the defects inherent in the work. And then he says, anything done for personal sense gratification is a cause of bondage. The conclusion is that everyone should be engaged according to the particular mode of nature he has acquired, and he should decide to work only to serve the supreme cause of the Supreme Lord. Did you all decide that? I'll read it again, see if you decided. The conclusion is that everyone should be engaged according to the particular mode of nature he has acquired, and he should decide to work only to serve the supreme cause of the Supreme Lord. Did you all decide that?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, according to this verse and many others, and we can look at the Bhagavatam as Radhika Raman once said, as a study of human failure, human weakness. After all, how does the Bhagavatam really start? Parikshit Maharaj. A flash of anger in this great Raja Rishi. He's a pure devotee. He comes from a family that's connected directly to Krishna. Krishna protected it in the womb. And he had a flash of anger. And what happened then? His life was basically, from a material standpoint, ruined. Death can ruin your whole day, right? Or notice it's, you're going to die. It's like, well, that really messes things up then, doesn't it? All my plans and everything. And so a little human frailty, a little goes a long way, because then he was on a completely different trajectory. Who else in the Bhagavatam had... Who? Chitraketu. Chitraketu was already in a position of great exalted spiritual... He had a great exalted spiritual stature, and he criticized Lord Shiva by laughing at him, and then he was cursed by Mother Parvati. That was a seeming, causing a seeming detour. Well, not a seeming detour. It did cause a detour. He had to take birth as a demon, and then he went back to Godhead. Any others? Ajamil. Yeah, so Ajamil was a dutiful Brahmin, and he, I mean, if you're going to fall down, I mean, Ajamil, he really set the standard. He came from an exalted family, and then he just lost it completely. I mean, he moved in with the prostitute. He did everything and anything to get money and so forth. And the Bhagavatam tells how he was protected. How he made a comeback. That's pretty inspiring. Who? Gajendra, yeah. Gajendra in his previous life was Indrajumna, and he got cursed, and he took birth as an elephant. And then you got Jain Vijay. I mean, the whole seventh canto is describing what happened with Jain Vijay, because they fell down from Vaikuntha. And Daksha is there. Bharat Maharaj.
Okay.
Again and again, we find the human frailty. What happened?
A quick announcement. Someone parked silver color Hyundai Elantra in the park, in the driveway of one of our neighborhood, you know, homes. So please move your car. License plate number is 7HWE750.
Silver Elantra. Okay. So, looking for perfection in creation is a flaw in itself. Statement I took from one of Radhika Raman Prabhu's writings. Looking for perfection in creation is a flaw in and of itself. This is helpful, I'm saying, in this idea of doing your best. Because in the process of doing your best in this world, you're going to meet with obstacles, many of them self-imposed. And if you consider the fact that all the great stories of the Bhagavatam, or practically anywhere else, are precipitated by some human frailty that leads to some difficulty, then in the process of moving forward, you may not feel overwhelmed. You may take inspiration from the stories from the Bhagavatam and others who have faced adversity by seeking for grace. Because this is the answer in all the cases in the Bhagavatam, that when there's a difficulty, when there's a slip, when there's insurmountable obstacles, this is the message that they looked for divine grace. One has to pray oneself out of that situation and to right oneself by taking deeper shelter of Krishna and the process of devotional service. Another point is that, so I talked about don't overdo, do what you can with what you have right now. And I'll just make a point about that. That in devotional consciousness, one sees the world as a place for service. I don't see that my ultimate goal is to become the center, and that my ultimate goal is to become more of a servant, and therefore being insignificant, taking an seemingly materially insignificant role is okay. And that's from whatever situation I'm in now, if I develop that seed desire, sincere seed desire, to do the best I can in devotional service, then that's good enough. Krishna will rectify any kind of anomaly that's within me if I have that sincere desire. And he'll also make all external adjustments so that it can move ahead. It comes from an internal level. So doing one's best may not appear externally at first, but if one continues to cultivate the feeling that I'm a sincere servant of Krishna and that I'm his instrument, and goes on with one's service to whatever capacity one can muster, then Krishna will make arrangements for one to move forward. Do you find that encouraging or comforting? I know I do. From whatever place I'm in, and oftentimes, or not oftentimes, but practically always, the world seems like an overwhelming proposition to face. And if one can take shelter of this seed that Krishna's in my heart, I sincerely try to do my service to the best of my capacity, wherever I am now, whatever I can do now, then I can overcome all obstacles, just like all of the great characters of the Bhagavatam who went through seemingly insurmountable difficulties and came out on the other side with Krishna's grace. Take shelter of grace. And this brings up another point for doing one's best, and that is to stay in the present. This is a powerful method of keeping one's balance and doing one's best, because the idea of future prospects and of the past things that I've done are outside of my circle of influence. And the present moment, what I can do right now with what's in front of me, is within my power. And therefore, it's very encouraging. There's a book written, David Allen wrote a runaway best-selling book, classic, about how to get things done. In fact, the book's called Getting Things Done. Getting Things Done, GTD. In fact, just the syllables now are institution unto themselves. There's GTD applications, there's GTD everything, because the book made so much sense. And one of the things that he says in his book is that be in the present and deal with what the next little thing is that you can do now. So what's the next little thing? In other words, say you have a big task to take care of, some legal problem. So what do you have to do? Well, become overwhelmed and then go to the kitchen and get some ice cream. And if you eat enough ice cream and then fall asleep, maybe that'll help, right? No. Mukharvin says no. Okay, so what will help is taking the next closest step to me that I can do. And in the book, he says, look closer, look at a simpler, what's the next possible step? It might be pick up that piece of paper that's on my desk, because that has a number on it that I have to call. And so what's the next step? Pick up the piece of paper. What's the next step? Pick up the phone. What's the next step? Make the call. Who knows what's going to happen? I don't know what will happen when I make the call, but if I at least take the next step and just try, then I'll be successful. I find this on book distribution all the time too, because oftentimes in going out into the world to distribute books, for example, it's overwhelming, because you think, how am I going to do this again today? What's going to happen when I knock on these doors or meet people on the street? After all, the world's always churning and we never know what's going to come out, right? So what do? Take the next step. Oftentimes when I go to a new environment, devotees say, come here and show us how to do a monthly Sankirtan festival. And I think, okay, is this going to work, Krishna? Is it going to work? Krishna, are you going to help? And I just take one step after another, and I'm thinking, how am I going to show these, say, 20 devotees are coming out, and they all think, let's see the magic. And I'm thinking, Krishna, where's the magic? And then I realize that the magic is in taking the next step. Because if I just say, okay, get ready. How do I get ready? Just like we always do. Put the books in the boxes, find out who's driving and things like that, and then just go out to the place as in an organized fashion as possible. What do you do then? Take the next step. You get out of the car. What do you do then? Walk up those steps. What do you do then? Knock on the door. What do you do then? Just deal with it. They open the door, just say, hi, what are you doing? It's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm an instrument. I'm here just doing what I can, right? And then Krishna does the rest. And this is the mode of being in the present. You take the very next step. You do your best with what you have right now. And you just move forward one tiny step at a time. What else can you do? And if I try to live outside my circle of influence, like many people live on the internet, and they have these suggestions for everybody in the world that they'll write and send out on a daily basis, that the world should be like this, should be like that, everyone should do this and do that. And I don't know if people really take those seriously. Whereas there's a realm one can live in where one lives very practically, for instance, in the discipline of Krishna consciousness. If you actually take your sadhana seriously every day, if you chalk out a time when you practice certain elements of your sadhana, and you do it in as focused way as possible, that's right in the middle of your circle of influence. You're hitting it right in the center. You're hitting the target. And you will feel satisfied, and you'll also feel productive. It's not that doing sadhana at home does not affect the entire world. It does, because so many people are working outside their circle of influence and giving wild suggestions that don't help anybody. But if one person actually takes their sadhana seriously, they become an influence all over the world. And we see, even in our Krishna consciousness movement, devotees who have taken their sadhana seriously. I just heard on the way in here, Kerr was telling me, in the corporate world, he was talking to some CEOs in his company or something, saying, yeah, we're going to see the Swami. And he was thinking, what is some Mayavadi Swami or whatever? And then he said, who is it? And he goes, it's a Amala Bhakta Swami. And he's thinking, well, Amala Bhakta is like 80 years old, and he's been practicing Krishna consciousness for 45 years now. And what does he do? He goes to Mangalarti every day. He chants at least 16 rounds every day. He reads all Prabhupada's books. And now he just walks around, and people go like, let's go hear from him. Because he has an influence, and it can actually change people. Other people who don't have sadhana, who don't live in the moment, live outside their circle of influence, but have plenty of suggestions on the internet, may not have such a powerful effect. So, being in the present and doing those activities that actually have an impact on one's personal qualification to prepare oneself for higher consciousness, prepare oneself in such a way that Krishna will be attracted and want to promote you to a higher level. Act with that kind of integrity in your own life, and then you can actually have an influence on the world, and you'll feel that you're doing your best. I'm doing the best sadhana that I can right now. And that's why this morning I was thinking while I was chanting my rounds, two syllables at a time. Because sometimes people say three mantras, and I think, that's too much for me. My mind can't handle that. It's too scrambled by all the screens I've been looking at, so I think, Two syllables is what I can handle. And I got intrigued a little bit with the two syllables. I think, what's in these syllables? All the acharyas are talking about there's nuclear power within two syllables, the name Krishna. What power does it produce? Rupa Goswami says, I don't know, but it's unlimited. There's a nuclear option. It's right inside there. And if I concentrate there, I do my best in that very second, in the present moment, to look at these two syllables, Hare, what's there? What is in that? And my consciousness gets diverted from all the other possibilities that are outside my control into those two syllables, Hare. Then there's some impact on the world. There's some impact on my personal capacity to appreciate the world as a place for service. And then I can actually do some good for the world. And I'm doing my best in that very moment. So don't be afraid to haul off and do some good sadhana and be in the moment. Don't be afraid to declare some sacred space for yourself to be in the moment where you can do the best you can with your sadhana. Don't feel obligated by anybody else to be distracted. You're not obligated to anybody ultimately but Krishna and your spiritual master to do your sadhana in a proper way. And you have the right to declare some sacred space and time to do that. And nobody else can tell you not to. You take a stand and be in that moment and do your best with what you have right now. And all the advancement in the world comes from that intention, that intentionality in doing your concentrated sadhana with attention. Intention leads to attention. So, I mentioned don't overdo things. Just find out what your capacity is and do what you can. Orient yourself to the present. Have a cherished goal and keep it in front of you. And then realize that your best is changing all the time. Because we have varying capacities because of the way the world churns. And if we can accept that at certain times in my life, certain times of the day, I have varying capacities, and I take advantage of that as much as possible when it's available, then I'll be doing my best. And don't become morose or tipped over by the fact that I can't do as well as I did yesterday, as far as keeping my attention and so forth. Just keep going and do the best you can with what you have right now that's keeping you in the present. Just remember your ability. Sometimes devotees have a good day chanting, and the other days they have a bad day chanting. Anybody? Yeah, it varies. Some days you have a great day on book distribution, other days, well, you guys always have great days, but that doesn't really apply. But there's a way that the world churns, and you have to wake up and do your duty according to your capacity on that every given day. I was in a meeting with leaders of North America at one meeting we had in Dallas, Texas, in a room, and I was kind of a new member in this body of leaders. And, you know, whenever you're in an organization, stay away from the executive branch as much as possible. Just a little advice. Because as soon as you get into the executive branch, you start getting a different vision of the world and how everything has its difficulties and faults and things like that. But somebody's got to do it. But when I found myself in that situation, I experienced a little mental strain and anxiety. And over the water cooler on the break, I talked to a seasoned veteran who was used to taking on all this stress and problems and responsibilities for things that seemed like impossible and ridiculous to deal with. And I said, "How do you deal with all this stuff?" And he said, "Well, life goes on." And I thought, wow, that's pretty useful. He said, no matter what happens, life goes on. You wake up the next day, and you do your sadhana, and you do the best you can with what you have. And you can observe in the life of Srila Prabhupada, if you read his letters from the very beginning, you'll see there were so many problems flying around that were difficult to deal with. In some cases, devotees sold a temple and just moved away. Suddenly, the temple that had been purchased, you know, they wrote in and said, yeah, such and such sold the temple, kept the money, and moved. How does that make you feel when you're in charge of the organization? What do you do then? Well, watch and see what Prabhupada did. You know, he did everything he could. He did troubleshooting for the situation to find out what could be recovered, who could be rectified. But it didn't tip him over. He just said, okay, what's done is done. Now let's move on to the next thing. And this is one of the techniques of doing your best, is not becoming overwhelmed by the circumstances, but saying, okay, it's the way the world moves. Look at the Bhagavatam. Look at the trouble that everyone, Bali Maharaj was in charge of the world, and he lost it all in a day when Vamana came and took it all away. And there's a way in which Indra, who is king of heaven, lost everything because he offended his spiritual master. Later on, Hiranyakashipu showed up, or earlier on, and usurped the whole universe. No one was expecting that one. One day, the demigods just woke up and said, there's a burning sensation coming from somewhere. And what is it? And, you know, the more they looked into it, the more dire the situation became. And what could anybody do about it? Brahma went there to appease Hiranyakashipu, and it turned out that because of his austerity, he owed him something, the law of the universe. And what did he want? Just control of everyone in the universe. And he gave it to him. And the next day, everyone was subjected to Hiranyakashipu's influence. That will wreck your day, huh? All your plans, everything you had going. Well, what do? They just kept going. Narada Muni did what he could. All the demigods went and prayed, said, Krishna, Vishnu, please come. We need your help. And we know what happened then. Krishna came and tore him to shreds. And the rest is history. So life goes on. These big problems come up. What was down is up, and what was up goes down. And then you say, what do I do now? Freak out? No, don't freak out. You do your duty. You do your best. You go on with what you have right now. What's your duty? And if you take the very basic duty that you have now, it's to chant Hare Krishna. And Prabhupada said this over and over again when people wrote him with problems. He said, it's the same old answer. Chant Hare Krishna. How do I get out of this situation? Who knows? But Krishna knows. He has an idea. And if you take shelter of higher consciousness by chanting, then you will find the solution by Krishna's mercy, by descending grace. So now we'll take a few reflections. Anything that you heard so far that stuck, that we can then rehear and encapsulate and take away with us, hopefully to have a better shot at it tomorrow. Malini.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Actually, I want to thank Dayaniti Prabhu for asking that question because this was the best class I ever heard. Every class keeps getting like that, but this was one of the best classes. The point that stuck me really was that the verse that you said about 1848, Bhagavad Gita, that even when we do our service, despite of our intentions, every service or every endeavor is covered with faults, just as smoke is covered by the fire. So, but I was just contemplating on this, how to rectify the situation. But this is very hopeful and good lecture that you gave, that you can only do the best you can. So I was really appreciative.
Knowing that is helpful, isn't it?
Yes.
And in a scholarly paper that was co-written by Krishna Kshetra Maharaj and Radhika Raman Prabhu, they wrote an introduction to an academic book that was published. They wrote about the churning of the milk ocean. And they point out in this paper, in the story of the churning of the milk ocean, that the demigods, of course, were in a tough situation, so who did they get the idea from how to move forward? Who gave them the idea how to move forward out of the difficult situation? Vishnu. And then they point out one after another how when the demigods went with this idea of churning the milk ocean, because they couldn't beat the demons, so there's an old adage, if you can't beat them, join them. So they joined, they made an armatus, and they joined together with the demons and said, well, let's get something out of this. Anyway, we'll churn the ocean and get some nectar so we can live for a long time. So then they got the idea from Vishnu, but then after the idea came, they had to get a churning rod. Where are they going to get that? A rod large enough to churn the ocean? They had to get the mountain, Mandara Mountain. But they couldn't carry it. They got smashed when they were carrying it. And so Vishnu had to come and not only carry it, and he just put it on Garuda's back. He just carried it, and Garuda just flew it over to the ocean. And meanwhile, he had to glance over all the demigods and demons and bring them back to life. So that's first failure in the process of trying to churn the ocean, but Vishnu saved them. Then they point out how the churning rod sank. So who's rectified that problem? Krishna again. He came as Kurma, the tortoise. But the tortoise has a round back, so the mountain doesn't quite stay. So then Vishnu had to go to the top also to hold it up, right? And then they tried churning, but it was so hard they couldn't quite do it. So who helped them churn? Vasuki, but then actually Vishnu himself had to come and pull the ropes because it was like too much for the demigods and demons. They couldn't do it. And then what happened? What came out of the ocean? The nectar, right? No! And this is one of the major points they make in the paper. When you do some endeavor, even if it's authorized by Vishnu, even if it's his idea, the created world is not perfect. And it's built into your endeavor that you're going to come up with some obstacles. This was a big obstacle. Poison came out. Even the vapors threatened to kill everybody in the universe. It was so poisonous. So then who helped? Shiva. They went, Lord Vishnu wanted to glorify his devotee. He said, so Lord Shiva, please save us. He said, I'll drink it. So for the sake of all living entities, drank it, held it in his throat. That's why he's known as Nilakanta. Still holding it in there to save everybody. Then the nectar came out. Who brought the nectar out? Vishnu in the form of Dhanvantari. He brought it out. And then the demigods got the nectar, right? It got stolen. I mean, how many things can go wrong when you try to do your service? So then the demons stole it, and who got it back? Vishnu. He took the form of a beautiful woman and went bewildered the demons, and they go, wow. She said, give me the nectar. And they go, okay. And so he took it. Mohini Murti took it, gave it back to the demigods, who began drinking it. And then Rahu sat down, drank some of it. Mohini Murti cut off his head. Head was preserved and so forth. And all through the pastime, we find that there was no explanation given for these failures. It's just expected. It's a part of creation. When creation takes place, there's some imperfection. Therefore, the Upanishads say, don't look for perfection in this world because it's created. And along with creation comes imperfection. And that's what Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita. It's a product of the three modes of material nature, and every endeavor is going to have some kind of fault to it. So don't freak out. But what you should do as you're performing your prescribed duty in this world is search for that place that's not created. Does such a place exist? Yes. The Upanishad said yes. There's a part, a different section of energy that's not created. That's perfect. Where do you first find it, according to the Upanishads? In yourself. The Upanishad says you look at yourself and you see there's a part of me that's not created. Krishna says it early on in the Gita. Dehi no smin yata dehe komaranyovaram jara tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatra namuyate. If you're a little bit steady, dhira, you don't freak out about everything, all the changes in the world. That should be the title of this, don't freak out. And you just observe what's real and what's not real. That's what's required. That's where the Gita starts. Find out what's real, what's not real. Any self-help guru in the world will tell you the same thing. Find out what's real, what's not real. Krishna is the supreme self-help guru. He tells us the same thing. Find out what's real, what's not real. If you observe for yourself, and that's altogether possible, even Prabhupada says in the Bhagavatam, for an ordinary person, we're not sure what kind of ordinary person he's talking about in this world, but ordinary people can introspect. Human beings can do this, and they can see there's something that's higher. There's something that's steady that's within. And the Upanishad says, find it. Find the steady place. Identify with that. Be dhira. And as the changes are going on in your body and in your life and in your work affairs and everything's going wrong around you and the poison's coming out, you have a place to take shelter. And that's our ultimate goal. Even as we work in this world and do our best, we'll find anomalies. But we keep our cherished goal in mind, and that is mentioned by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, that there's a supreme abode that's never destroyed when this world's destroyed. And there's, we have a place there. That's our place. And we actually have nothing to do with this material world. I know, we were on reflections. Let me hear a few more. Kameshri.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. So, one point that you were mentioning about when we go on book distribution, there's a feeling what is going to happen, and that is so much. Every Saturday when we prepare to go out, and also with this feeling it overcomes, what is going to happen? Will somebody take the books or not? And who is bringing books? And who is going where? And you know, there is a lot of logistics. And you were mentioning Chaitanya Charitamrita hasn't been distributed so much. And when we go out, especially now, distributing Chaitanya Charitamrita, actually people don't know who is Lord Chaitanya. And we are trying to present them, this is Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya's life sketch, that Lord Krishna himself came down as a devotee, in the form of a devotee, and showed us as an example. And they said, okay, but I don't know much about this really happening. And then we keep going, and as you were mentioning it, praying out of the situation. So yesterday when we went out, this is the answer we were getting. Actually, we haven't heard about Lord Chaitanya really. So we kept on going though, and we met one nice person, and he said, "Yeah, I heard about it, but I don't know much." And he's from North India. And then he said, "Yeah, I don't know much. I don't know if I want to study his life sketch." And then we had a discussion how it has so many beautiful pastimes of love with his devotees, loving exchanges, and especially Jagannath Puri. And after much discussion, he said, "Well, my house is all cluttered. I don't barely have any space." And then you can take a look. Then. As we learned, we mentioned in the space of the home doesn't matter, the space of the heart matters.
Ooh. And wow. You guys are something.
And then he smiled and said, "Yeah, but maybe..." "Maybe it has to stay in garage then, is that okay?" Then I said, "Yes, it can stay in garage too, that's fine." Then he said, "But it will get the dust." Then we mentioned, you can just put it in a box, the same box, and then you take one book at a time and read as you go on. And then he said, "All right, tell me how to read this." And then finally he took, but as we were going through so many arguments, like not exactly arguments, but his concerns, actually it was like a praying out of the situation. We were praying within our hearts that somehow the Lord please inspire him to take these books so that, you know, he can get your mercy. So that was a pretty, very, actually, distributing Chaitanya Charitamrita is very intense. I was just thinking about what you're saying, praying out of the situation. Even though you mentioned in terms of calamities, but even going out with distribution, actually, it's all throughout, it's an intense prayer that only actually, how we distribute Chaitanya Charitamrita is only because, you know, Lord is inspiring other people, and somehow or other if we are praying.
It's the best kind of prayer because the stakes are much higher. If you pray at home with nothing on the line, it's a different kind of prayer. But when you put everything on the line and then you pray as you're trying to do something active by distributing a set of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the prayer is much more powerful. It's much more intense. It's something active. And a couple other points about that, just to reiterate that we are pioneers in spreading Lord Chaitanya's movement. Now we may say, "Well, we've got temples all over the world." Yes, but people still don't know who Lord Chaitanya is. People still don't know about his philosophy. That's why Prabhupada wrote the teachings of Lord Chaitanya as fast as he could, which is a summary of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and then he wrote the Chaitanya Charitamrita as fast as he could. It's important for Lord Chaitanya's movement to spread all over the world that people know who Lord Chaitanya is. Where is that knowledge available? In the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And so we are the pioneers. And how much spiritual credit do you get by going out and taking your life energy to explain who Lord Chaitanya is? And in the process, how much do you edify your own understanding of who Lord Chaitanya is? Because anybody might think, well, who is Lord Chaitanya? But until you actually have to go stand up for him and say, this is who he is, and then you may come home and say, well, I really don't know who he is yet. I better find out. Siddhanta Bhulya Chaitanakara Alash, then Iha Hoite Krishna Lagi Sudharin Manash, you better study it and find out, says Kaviraj Goswami. And when you do, you'll be very powerful. When you hear from these great enlightened personalities who know who Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is and they have reciprocation with him, then you become powerful. And one last point about that is that the jiva in this world is called tatasta. And tatasta means neither here nor there. It means he can be swayed by suggestion, open to suggestion. Every jiva is open to suggestion. That's why people campaign so hard. They go like, here, this guy's good, that guy's good, this guy. And everybody's like presenting somebody because some jiva look at it and goes, yeah, that's pretty good, I'll take it. And when we go out, we're campaigning for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, for Krishna. And that's just what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said to do. And that's what Krishna says to do in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, those who do this kind of campaign are the most dear to me. It's a much better campaign because a lot of these candidates, I would say a lot, all of them, are fallible people. But when we campaign for Krishna, when we campaign for Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you can actually put your heart behind it. Get a little sign, go out on the street corner and say, yay, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Take a set of books. Two more reflections. Yes.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. So, Prabhuji, I like the point that we should always remember that we are not the doer, but we should be the instruments in Krishna's hands. Similar situation happened a few weeks ago during the book distribution. Actually, we were able to distribute one Chaitanya Charitamrita set very quickly. That person got convinced. And then we went upstairs the husband was very curious. He knew about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but the wife was not very happy about it. Him buying the set. But during that conversation, because of seeing the husband's curiosity, I thought, okay, now again we are going to distribute the second set. It is so nice that, and I was like very, very excited. But then later, when the wife refused, he also refused to buy the set. And then I'm like, yeah, I should really think about that. I'm not the doer, but it's about Lord's mercy. And we are just trying to be instrument in his hands. So
yeah, and you learn a lot about how the material energy works too. Like, you know, when in spousal dealings. Because the Bhagavatam says a lot about it. And then when you see it in front of you, like this used to happen all the time. I would be in the airport and, you know, say this happened because in the place I used to distribute in O'Hare Airport, we were in a hallway just where all the flights would come out, people would come out, and there were restrooms on either side. So a lot of times people get off the plane and say, like, the wife would go in the restroom, the guy's waiting outside. And he'd be just about to buy a book, and the wife comes out, goes, nope, grabs it, gives the book back, walks away, and I think, okay, I see how this works. And in that frustration, there's a lot of revelation that comes. I mean, there's not one thing that happens when you're out doing your duty to spread Krishna consciousness that doesn't help you mature and become a better devotee. And the so-called failures are also pillars to success. Something from the internet. Someone from the internet. And by the way, we welcome all the devotees who have joined us here on the internet. Everyone, please turn towards the camera and say, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Okay, two more minutes.
This is Dayanidhi Prabhu.
Dayanidhi. Thanks, Dayanidhi. Okay.
Thank you, Vaisheshika Prabhu. Thank you, Vaisheshika Prabhu. My cherished goal is to be like you.
I would just suggest to aim a little higher.
I liked many things you said, especially the good japa, and also that the magic is in taking the next step. I took a lot of notes. I thank Malini for being such a humble and inspiring devotee.
That's all we have.
Can I just add?
Yes, please add.
I like the new term I learned today, the spiritual Mona Lisa.
Spiritual Mona Lisa, yeah. So, actually, we have to end because we have like 60 seconds left. Do you have a quick point?
Yes, Maharaj. I just wanted to share about the circle of influence that you talked about.
Yes.
That past cannot be controlled, but present can be. And it really depends on how your sadhana is. If you have a really deep sadhana and strong sadhana, then Krishna will somehow intervene and will help you to go to the next stage.
Yeah. You know, we had a japa seminar when we were in Jagannath Puri. Where did we have it? At Haridas Thakur's Bhajan Kutir at Sudha Bukul. And one of the points that Satyadev Prabhu made during that time was a quotation from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's poem, in which he says, "Forget the past that sleeps, of the future never think at all, act in times that are with thee, and progress you shall call." And he just brought attention to this, what is seemingly commonplace kind of a statement, and said, this is the essential point for concentrating on japa, just be in the present. And it's such an important point to do what you can with what you have, but be in the moment and do it right now. So now we get an opportunity to sing, and not many people do in Silicon Valley, unless they go to karaoke or something like that, and that's kind of silly. But this is singing from our heart to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, spiritual mantras that will affect our every cell in our body and take us back home, back to Godhead. So we'll put all the seats away and we'll stand up and we'll sing for Radha and Krishna. Shri Shri Radha Madan Mohanji ki jai, Shriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Shri Lakshmi Nisingadev ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Bhaktivrinda ki jai, Go Premanande Haribo!
Marman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Hey! Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.